What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Sarah Tyson, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Colorado, Denver, and I'm co-host of the channel, along with Carrie Fichtor, Robert Talese, and Alexis McLeod. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Elizabeth Paquette, Assistant Professor of Women's and Gender Studies and Philosophy at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. Her book, Universal Emancipation, Race Beyond Badu, is just out from the University of Minnesota Press. What is Badu's theory of emancipation? For whom is this emancipation possible? Does emancipation entail an indifference to difference? In Universal Emancipation, Paquette pursues these questions through a sustained conversation with decolonial theory, particularly the work of Sylvia Winter. Through consideration of negritude and the Haitian Revolution, Paquette argues for a theory of emancipation that need not subtract particularities, as Badu theorizes, but rather build a pluriconceptual framework, as Winter theorizes, for emancipation based on solidarity. Welcome, Elizabeth, to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for being here today. Would you start by telling us a bit about yourself, your background as a philosopher, and how you came to write this book based on your interests?
Yeah, absolutely. So I can start with my training. My training is in Ontario universities. I studied a lot of continental philosophy. I read a lot of Hegel, a lot of Heidegger, and Beauvoir. But I've always had an interest in social political philosophy, which I started developing in graduate school. And so I'd read, Marx and Hobbes and Locke, and then Aristotle's Politics and Hegel's Politics. And then I started getting into Althusser, Balibar, and Badiou. And so there's always been this sort of French social political theory path that I was on that ultimately led me to Badiou, which is the topic of the book that I wrote here. But aside from that, there are two other really big things that went into writing this book. And the first one is that in reading Badiou, I was having a struggle with some of the things that he was saying. And so in a certain sense, I was drawn to it because I understood sort of where he was coming from and where he was trying to go. But there was always something that didn't quite sit right for me in thinking about what he was trying to do in this, in his very large corpus. And so I started attending conferences. I went to Philosophy Born Struggle, to the Caribbean Philosophical Association. And when attending these conferences and chatting with folks, it started to really push my understanding of politics and what politics were and what they could do. So I had this kind of pushing it in the struggle and these questions at the same time. Back in September of 2016, I remember sitting down in a coffee shop and I was going to read Badiou about revolution. And a couple of days before this, African-American man in Charlotte, Keith Amont Scott, was murdered by police officers. And so I don't know if everyone remembers, but Charlotte, there were protests in Charlotte following Keith Amont Scott's murder. And so it was weeks upon weeks of people protesting in the streets calling for change. And I was thinking about myself sitting in this coffee shop reading Badiou's sort of abstract philosophy about revolution when there is something happening in Charlotte that was a call to action. And so basically what happened is I left there and I went and I found folks to support and to organize with. And then a month later, I came back to the book. And then in that, I started sort of to confront the struggles that I was having with Badiou and to start thinking about what it is that philosophy should be doing and what my work, what I wanted my work to be doing in response to the things that were happening in Charlotte then, that were happening way before then and continue happening now. And sort of that's how I came to thinking about and working through this book, which ultimately is thinking about how it is that, race and racial emancipation fits into a theorist like Badiou and how he calls for emancipation.
Yeah, and so this is one of the primary concerns of your book is about Badiou's demand that emancipation, he says that it demands an indifference to difference and that race is a particularity that must be overcome. And mm-hmm. you argue that there is an irreducible Eurocentrism to this view, and it sort of makes you sitting in that coffee shop yeah. such a crystallization of I think the issues the book struggles with. And mm-hmm. so would you first help us understand how Badiou comes to think of emancipation in this way, why this is a compelling view for him?
Yeah, absolutely. And so again, like I can think about the historical parts of it. And so for Badiou, he's trying to deal with his disillusionment of why May 68 failed. He's turning away from party politics at this point in time. And so instead, he's turning to thinking about organizing. And so he's organizing with various groups. And so with all these newspaper articles that talk about the kinds of work that he's doing in that framework. He also turns to set theory, which is, not very conventional term, I think, for French political theorists. And so I had to go and take courses on set theory and to try and understand what set theory is and why that matters for him. But ultimately, he is concerned with revolution. He's concerned with thinking about the difference between, I think, revolution and reform. And so in a certain sense, he thinks that, it's not good enough just to sort of reform a state to make it a little bit better, but something new has to come about. And so he's working through that in various kinds of ways, and he's trying to think about, what does that revolution look like? And so he calls for this total break, and then the question becomes for him, what does that total break look like, and what's required in order to get to it? And so he's trying to distinguish that from, what there is. And so in some sense, he's a phenomenologist, and so he's thinking about what there is versus, the new in this other kind of way. And so there's a ton of technical language that he engages with that I'll talk a little bit about now, although I don't want to get too much into the set theory, which is the foundation for it, but thinking instead about the social political implications for what he's talking about. Mm. He talks about worlds, and so we all live in worlds, and worlds are organized in certain kinds of ways. And he says that they're all organized by this thing called the transcendental index, right? And so this is, again, it's not really a new concept, right? So we have people talking about how worlds are organized by, white supremacy, how they're organized by colonialism, capitalism, so in a certain sense, like that's consistent with social political theory, for a while. But then in addition to worlds, we also know that there are states for him. And so he distinguishes, states in a world from the other side. And his concern about states is thinking about, how is it that that people, or what he calls bodies, get counted by the state. And so ultimately his concern is he's saying a state is always going to fail. It's never going to be able to account for all those who are within the state. And so we can think, for instance, the debates around long-form census. Long-form census is always going to exclude people who are living in the United States and Canada. So it's always going to fail in that kind of way, not only because of just how it operates, but also because of the implicit things that are involved in it as well. If we're talking about, how it is that, nation states, they count some people more than others, and it requires citizenship or residency of some kind, And so there's all these stipulations about how it is that people get counted in these ways. But importantly for Baidu, this also means because, you know, there's a transcendental index that organizes both worlds and states, like it can change, right? So it doesn't mean that the way things are is the way that they have to remain. It means that things can be different because they're contingent upon what that world is or what that state is. And so ultimately, he's concerned with what he calls the inexistent. And again, a lot of these terms go back to set theory, but basically he's talking about how it is that people get left out of the count and what does it mean for people to be accounted for and counted for what he says, how the inexistent appears within a state. And again, he's not saying that we just need to count people differently. He's saying that we need a wholly new state, you know, so that those who are inexistent can appear. And so this is how we get to emancipation. Emancipation is an attempting to address the solution to the problem of how the count will always leave people out. And so he says, well, how do we figure out what that is and where do we look? And so his first point is we can't look to the state. Now, you can't look to the state to solve the solution because the state, a state that was going to maintain itself in a certain kind of way, it's going to maintain its power. And so it's going to do whatever it can to maintain its power. And so this is how he gets to the distinction he makes between additive politics and subtractive politics. Additive politics are politics that he's not for, and it's when a state kind of just keeps expanding to include more, but doesn't actually change. And so one of the examples that I have in the book is same-sex marriage. So in 2015, same-sex marriage became recognized by the United States federally. You know, it was already in various states, but federally became recognized. And so in a certain sense, what we have here is an extension of rights to marry by the state to more people, right? So you're adding more people in here. So no longer just for opposite-sex people, it's also for same-sex people. But that the state determines who can marry and not hasn't really changed. It just sort of looks a little bit different. And so what he turns to think about subtractive politics, to justice. And again, this is not necessarily a new question about justice. This is something that's been going on for quite a while. Where do we get what justice is? How do we understand what it is? If it comes from the state might only be concerned and usually is only concerned about maintaining its own structure such that justice always refers back to maintaining the state. And so what happens if a state is inherently unjust? Where do you turn? You have to turn to something that exceeds that. Because you'll never find the answer within the thing itself. And so justice then becomes as something that exceeds the state that we can turn to for thinking about emancipation. And so for him, justice is truth. And truth is this thing that's universal because it's not determined by the transcendental index. It's not determined by the state. It exceeds it. And it's something that we can use to found revolutionary movements. And that's what he calls subjective politics, is this turn to truth, turn to truth procedures, and this turn to what exceeds the state, for providing that kind of foundation. And so truth procedures is sort of a complicated concept for him that he works out in all these various ways, but they're usually retrospective. You can't know what justice is sort of after. You have to name it. It has to be a movement from the people, which is a kind of very generic term for him. He's looking at, and it's just forcing this change to come about. So retrospectively, we'll look and say, "Oh, look, this is when that sort of movement started." And so it's not about electing new representatives. It's not about that kind of state politics, but it's about sort of turning to something that exceeds the state that's inherently unjust because of the way that it excludes people from the count. And so you can think of the Algerian Revolution as an example of that, maybe the South African anti-apartheid movement of all sort of reconstructing states according to new principles, and the Haitian Revolution, which we'll talk about a little bit later too. And so for him, that's the thing that's necessary. It's necessary to turn to subjective politics, this move to justice, and justice as a kind of truth that exceeds how it is that the state operates. And so this is kind of how you get to thinking about what he calls the indifference to difference or indifferences. And so for him, politics must be indifferent to difference. And basically that means that it can't be based on things that are based in the state. So he draws this distinction between universal truth, justice on the one hand, on the other side, different particularity, and then sort of what there is on the other side. And the difference, the different side is thinking about what's determined by the state, and then the universal and truth are what would exceed the state in these various ways. So that's really sort of where the rubber hits the road for me, is thinking about, well, what does he mean by difference? What does he mean by particularity? And how is it that those operate within his theory? And what does it mean to exclude those things? And the important part about that is that when he thinks about things that are particular or what counts as difference, he means explicitly culture on the one hand. Culture can never be political, and they're inherently in opposition with each other. And he also thinks that race is something that's based in the state, it's based in difference, and based in particularity, and therefore can never be part of politics or this universal move.
Yeah, and so this is, you use the Sartre and Fanon's debate about negritude to set up your critique of the indifference to difference for Badiou. And part of the reason this debate seems so productive for you as a framing is because Sartre and Fanon are in such opposition about whether race or particularity has to be sublated for universal emancipation. Mm-hmm. And you sort of align Sartre and Badiou on one hand, and then Fanon, Césaire, Winter, and many other readers of negritude on the other. And so, so why this genealogy, right? Like, why set it up using this debate? What was compelling to you about the Sartre-Fanon debate that made it such a productive site for thinking through this problem you saw in Badiou?
Yeah, and I think you really you got on the nose there. Like, it was so formative for my thinking about what was happening in Badiou, and it's because Badiou sees himself as a Sartrean, and the connection between Winter and Fanon is very strong, as well as also Césaire. And so when this debate came up between Fanon and Sartre, in a certain sense, I was like that thing is already there. That debate, the conversation, in many ways, is already there between Fanon and Sartre. And I was surprised that one, you know, readers of Badiou hadn't thought about it, and also, I mean, Badiou himself had never thought about it. You know, this is not something that's hidden. It's not something that is not talked about. It's a very, very much prevalent. And he never actually returned to that discussion that they had. And all of it really turns around discussions of negritude. And so I use negritude throughout the book. It comes up at various points in time, and it's become a really sort of central touch point for all these authors. And that's also because, so I had my suspicions about Badiou back in 2015, 2016. And then in 2016, he published a book called Black. And in this very small book, he starts talking about the negritude movement. And so this is really sort of his first time where he talks about race, and he talks about the negritude movement explicitly. And when I read that, everything fell into place. You know, the debate sort of laid it out really clearly, and he was explicitly taking a side that was very implicit in the rest of his works. So for those who don't know, I mean, the Fanon Sartre debate happens between Black Orpheus and Black Silhouette Mass in Chapter 5. And it's a discussion about negritude and what negritude can do, and how it is that we need to think about in relation to politics. And so again, like it's drawing on this idea of what the role of politics is. And so Sartre proposes in this essay, Black Orpheus, which is the introduction to a negritude reader that was put together by Senghor. He says that race is something that has to be overcome in order to achieve emancipation. And so he's dealing with this juxtaposition between class and race. And so again, this goes back to a number of people who've talked about the tension that exists between class and race in often classical Marxism. And so the idea is that, you know, race is something that's particular, just like Badiou says. Yes, race consciousness is important, But ultimately, it's one step along the way to universal emancipation, which we get to through class. And so what Fanon is dealing with is saying, well, what does it mean for you to say that race is something that once gets over and then you turn to class? And so what he's locating is that there's a hierarchy that starts to be developed by Sartre to say, well, you know, race is important, but yes, but class is actually more important because class impacts all of us, whereas race only impacts some people. And so this turns this conversation about how race is not universal because it only impacts some people and not others. And class is something that, you know, all of us need to sort of come to. And so he engages in discussion about, you know, sublimating race, or to get universal emancipation in these very same ways. And so Fanon is read in a number of different ways in this debate. And so I don't want to say, in a certain sense, you know, Fanon rejects negritude, according to a number of Fanon scholars. I wouldn't debate that. But the point that I sort of want to focus on is that he does say that the idea that, you know, class is more important than race, or that there is that dialectical relationship, or that, you know, he has to get over his race to get to class, is inherently problematic. So regardless of sort of where the endpoint is, that point reinforces this racial hierarchy that had already existed.
Because what you start setting up there then is the importance of like a positive conception of race, right? Kind of regardless of how Fanon and Sartre work it out, there's a genealogy of that positive conception.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there's sort of two parts to it, right? And so there's the one hand, the idea that, you know, race is something that's only negative, that has to be gotten over. But then there is this positive side as well. And again, like this, the positive side of race is, again, a contentious point, and not all Fanon scholars would agree that that's the case. But what I do through a number of critical race theories is sort of locate how it is that race is conceived as something that's different from this particular thing that has to be gotten over. And so we can think back to Badiou, and in race being particular for him, it means that race is something that was determined by hierarchical structures. And so we could think to Fanon talking about how the white gaze imposed upon him a conception that he was racialized. And that's true, and that's a negative conception of race that Catherine Tobia Bell outlines very beautifully in this essay about Fanon as well. But in addition to that, there are other conceptions of race that are operating. And so for Badiou and Sartre, there's sort of no regard for this positive conception of race. But there is also a very strong history about thinking about how race is something more than what has been determined by the state, by white supremacy, by the white gaze, for instance. And so, I mean, you can turn to another people like Fanon in 1952, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote The Conservation of Race in 1897, where he's arguing that there is something other than this negative conception of race, and that there's something about race that can be sort of maintained, even if the overcoming of racism. And so it's not a matter of like, well, you just get over race and then you move on to class, but that there's something that can be maintained and something that can be persistent. And that conception of race is really important to think about when we think about politics. Lucius T. Outlaw Jr. and T.K. Jeffers also offer these really beautiful discussions about what positive conceptions of race look like in talking about W.E.B. Du Bois. And T.K. Jeffers in particular talks about Black joy and what Black joy is. And so all of that is about thinking about all these positive ways in which one can think about race, rather than thinking of it as something that just needs to be gotten over, so that needs to be sublated. I think that this is something that's really, really prevalent in certain Marxist thinking, and it's thinking about how it is that these categories come up. And so the way that I think about it sometimes is that for Marxists, the proletariat is a category that's determined by capitalism. And so after you have the revolution, the category of the proletariat will no longer exist. Right? That's the foundation for the revolution. There should be no more class. There should be no more proletariat. And so they sort of map that on to thinking about race at the same time. You know, after the revolution, there should be no race because race was a product of that hierarchical structure. But what W.E.B. Du Bois, Fanon, Outlaw, Jeffers have all been saying is that that doesn't actually map on the same way, and that instead we also need to be accounted for a positive conception of race. And so, I mean, in addition to these things, there's all these other reasons why a positive conception of race is so important. And so I really like how Catherine Sevilla Bell, and she talks about how positive conceptions of race are important for thinking about collective memory. Yeah, and so even Fanon, like, he talks about, like, talking about having, like, a Black history and how Black history is so important for a Black future. And I think that resonates also with the importance of the positive conception of race. Outlaw talks about how conceptions of race as positive are also reasons for engaging in politics. And Sylvia Winder talks about it as, you know, that provides a condition for both knowledge and understanding. And so my reading of negritude, which again, like, is often not, it's not a very conventional reading of negritude often, but I think this is what negritude is attempting to do. It's attempting to think about how it is that race is something that is not just negative, not just that it needs to be overcome, but it's something that's positive, that's creative, that's dynamic, that's changing over time, that's future oriented, and therefore also political at the same time.
I think about, you know, at the end of Mama's Baby, Papa's Maybe, Hortense Spillers talks about like gaining the insurgent ground. There's such a conceptualization of the creative potential in monstrousness, you know, and like that sort of positive conception out of in an essay that's really clearly acknowledging the negative formation of race, right? But that there's this also this profound care about positive conceptions and what can be built and what can be remembered and how that can fund creative possibilities.
Yeah.
And so Badiou, in a sense, is like, he has this anti-racist impulse with the indifference or like it's not just an impulse, right? It's an elaborate sort of theoretical scheme, right?
Yeah.
To try
yeah.
to deal with racism. But it misses this, right? It misses this, this whole line of thinking about a positive conception of race that you're identifying.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, like, there are a number of ways that, again, we can approach Badiou with this. You know, in a certain sense, we could ask, like, well, can't you just add it in, or could it look differently? But I think that for Badiou and his theory, that there's a fundamental problem that happens in his theory, because his entire theory is based on this indifference, it's based on subjective theory. And it's not just, you know, all now that we have a positive conception of race. It just fails to get to that point. And I think it's because it reinforces a Eurocentric framework. And again, like, this is something that in a certain sense Badiou is attempting to address in his theory, right? So he's saying, like, oh, we can't look to whatever it is that's organizing us, we have to look to what exceeds us. But ultimately what ends up happening is that he's further entrenching a European structure, a European conception of emancipation in his political theory. So he could be a critique of himself if he was aware of it, but I'm not sure.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, but it's a positive conception of white supremacy, right, is impossible. And so there's a way in which, like, that has to be overcome for emancipation. But he's not, because of the Eurocentric view, right, he's not taking on this whole other possibility. Fanon, Césaire, Winter. Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, it's been a conversation that's been happening for, you know, at least since W.E.B. Du Bois back in, 1897, but if not, and also, you know, before that. And so, I mean, in a certain sense, what has to happen is it's not the subtractive thing that has to happen. It has to be more about situating a project from a marginal position. And unless he does that, unless he can do that, which is inconsistent with the project that he's offered, it'll just end up recentering white folks and the Eurocentric structure over and over again. And so one of the ways for me, one of the key texts I keep coming back to, you know, I think that Horton Spiller's text is amazing. And also Kimberly Crenshaw, Mapping the Origins. You know, and so her articulation there about, you know, what does gender oppression look like? And how does addressing gender oppression, like what are ways that it's done and what are some of the implications of it, right? And so she talks about how, you know, if you think about gender along a single axis, you will recenter white women because you've actually failed to address how it is that gender oppression is complicated by racial oppression and how you can't think of those things separated from each other. And so that's the kind of thing that I think that Badji is doing. He's trying to sort of separate things and say, you know, we're concerned with the plural in this way, we won't talk about race. What that does is that'll recenter white folks in a very similar way. And so again, with this idea of thinking about class over race, and again, this is not new to me. This is a conversation that's been going on for a very long time, that if you think about class to the exclusion of race, what you end up doing is you end up centering white proletariat workers to the exclusion of, you know, the multitude of proletariat and working class people who won't get accounted for in these ways. So Aimé Césaire named this in his letter to Marie Thérèse in 1956 when he resigned from the French Communist Party. Cedric Robinson begins Black Marxism in 1983 with the same point. Leon Trotsky in 1930, yeah. You know, he's naming that, you know, if white workers want to support Black workers, they have to say, well, we support you on your own terms and not put you in service to us. You know, when I read that, like I was flabbergasted, you know, again, because this same narrative comes up over and over again about how class is the universal race is something you have to get over. But this argument has happened in various circles over and over again for, you know, at least the last 100 years, if not more. And so I think that, like, these conversations about universality, that's like a little, that's abstract, or, you know, it's not quite formed from any particularity. I think it often runs a risk of falling into these kinds of hierarchies and kinds of problematic structures. And I hear that actually, I hear this a lot about at climate change. And this came up in discussion about this in my book at one point in time, and I was asked, you know, what about climate change? Isn't climate change the thing that impacts us all? We don't worry about race, but we worry about climate change. I've been thinking about this question more and more, and the more I read, you know, climate change is something that's already impacting marginalized folks, already impacting Black and brown folks. It's not this future devastation. It's something that's been happening, you know, for, you know, 150 years, if not more. What happens in that discussion of climate change is what people become primarily concerned with it because it's going to impact them and not recognizing it's been impacting folks for a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to understand what's going on in contemporary Bangladesh without thinking about it as climate-driven migration and, or like that COVID was called initially the Great Equalizer, right? And it's like, that's not how it's playing out. So one of the historical events, or like series of historical events, you then take us to is the Haitian Revolution, to think through positive conceptions of particularity, and you especially focus on this 1805 constitution. So how does this, will you first of all, like how did the Haitian Revolution become this sort of touch point, because it works so well in your critique of Badiou? I was like, right, I see, you know, it really works. So how did you get there to using that? And then will you tell us about how the Haitian Revolution helps you do some of this work?
Yeah. I mean, so the Haitian Revolution, it came up for a number of reasons. So one, Badiou references the Haitian Revolution in some of his political writings. And so he names sort of this moment as like, you know, as an example of his conception of emancipation. But that was a really sort of short line or two that he sort of just injects. But then what happened is that Nick Nesbitt actually wrote one book, and he talks about it in other books as well, where he's using Badiou's framework to think through the Haitian Revolution. So that was really helpful, first of all, that like there are people who are doing Badiou studies on the Haitian Revolution, so I could turn to these various resources, including Badiou himself, even though he doesn't spend a whole lot of time on it. I think that it became to be a really a hard problem, I think, for thinking about how it is that Badiou thinks about emancipation, how he thinks about universal emancipation. And so, and in some ways, it's also because it's very much a touchstone event in thinking about race and politics. You know, so it has all this history behind it, all these discussions about it, and both Badiou and Badiou scholars are working on this problem, this question. The general points about it, you know, are the Haitian Revolution for Badiou. He calls it emancipatory in the way that he talks about emancipation. You know, he calls it political in the way that the principles of it transcend the state rather than are imminent to it. And so, right, it has conceptions of justice justice against dehumanization is sort of the foundation for it. And therefore, he says that something is political, right? So it checks all those boxes for Badiou. It's emancipatory because it's political, because it's universal. Which also means that for Badiou, it can't be based in race, which is really interesting. And also, it can't be cultural, right? So because for him, cultural is something that's based in states, it's imminent to it, and that culture can't be political in those ways. And this is also how he like juxtaposes the Haitian Revolution and the Negritude movement. So the Negritude movement is inherently a cultural movement for Badiou, and therefore can't be political. And by correspondence, you know, the Haitian Revolution is universal, and therefore it can be political in these ways. And so Nick Nesbitt, in his discussion of it, and again, this is in some ways a very mainstream way of thinking about the Haitian Revolution, is it has these inherent ties to the French Revolution, right? So the French Revolution happened, you know, just prior to the start of the Haitian Revolution. And so what we see is Toussaint Louverture, who was, you know, one of the main figures of the Haitian Revolution, writes documents in 1792 and also the 1801 Constitution of Saint-Domingue, which is what it's called at this point in time, sort of setting the foundation for. And in this document, this Constitution, you know, he's really depending upon the language of the French Revolution. So thinking about the rights of man as something that is universal. And therefore, for Badiou, can be emancipatory and political, right? So it falls, again, it checks all those boxes for him. And so all those things are true, definitely. I'm not debating them. But what I find really interesting is that, you know, for Nesbitt and Badiou, that these are the documents they choose, but that's only part of the story of the Haitian Revolution. So I started reading more folks on the Haitian Revolution and started looking back into, you know, the rest of the history of the Haitian Revolution and what this story leaves out, you know, and it leaves out that, you know, in 1801, Haiti, which is actually Saint-Domingue, is still a French colony, right? So Saint-Domingue was a French colony, and it wasn't until 1804 that they declared themselves independent of the French colony, because they're of the French colonial nation state. And so because they are still a French colony, they're still subject to French colonial rule. Also at the same time, you know, forced labor still exists on the island. And so we can think, well, how is it that you think of, you know, the Haitian Revolution according to the rights of man in 1801 when there's still forced labor been happening simultaneously? Napoleon is also threatening to reimpose slavery on Saint-Domingue, given that he is like also now in charge or still in charge of the French colonial state. And then also Maoise, who is a nephew of Toussaint and who was fighting along with Toussaint, critiques Toussaint, saying that Toussaint's, you know, his 1801 constitution is Toussaint trying to appease the white landowners who remained in Saint-Domingue at that time. And so Maoise says, you know, we really need to focus on the Black people from Saint-Domingue and think about revolution in this other kind of way. So again, it's not until 1804 that Haitians declare a sovereign nation. They're no longer under colonial rule. And in 1805, they create a constitution. And in this constitution, they declare that all citizens of Haiti are Black. And so, I mean, this raised a number of questions to me. You know, so why is it that Nesbitt does not think about the 1805 constitution? And what does this mean for Badiou's political theory? If we follow it through to the 1805 constitution and these various critiques about slavery, colonization that existed over the 1792 and 1801, 1801 constitution, And so what we see is that, you know, while 1801 engages in the language of universality, the 1805 document clearly centers race. And so for Badiou, you know, it raises the question, is because of that, does it then become a cultural movement for Badiou? Or is it political, and political in a way that centers race? You know, and so Badiou doesn't seem to be able to include race, you know, the way that I've talked about it before. And then what does it mean to say that it's a cultural movement, not a political one? You know, if there's a political movement for emancipation, Haitian Revolution is really held up as, you know, one of the foremost moments when, you know, the people changed the structure of the state and created one in which they were no longer in existence and they appear, right? So it seems to fit, but the structure that Badiou has provided for us, it doesn't really work in that way. So what I do with this example is I use it as, you know, to show the limitations of Badiou theory. You know, given his structure, either it's the case of the Haitian, either it's the case that you can include race given the 1805 constitution, or it's the case that he would think it's a cultural movement, which would be inherently problematic. And in all cases, what it shows is that Badiou's failure to account for race in thinking about emancipation is a failure of his system writ large. You know, it's a problem that we can't quite think ourselves out of given his framework.
Yeah, there's sort of this inflexibility about how to think through historical events, right? Like we're just not going to talk about 1805, right? Like, well, there's some other places. We like these other events. They fit. And so we'll just focus on those. And so this way that history then has to get reframed, right? There's a, it's subtractive, right? Like these certain events have to get subtracted out.
And I think that, I mean, that raises a really interesting point about Badiou. You know, a lot of the discussions around him too is, you know, what's the role of history in his corpus and his theory? And it seems as though like history plays a really small role in this way. But history is really important, especially for, you know, marginalized folks, you know, and so maintaining history and maintaining one's own history, one's own story becomes particularly important, and not just something that, you know, just goes away kind of thing.
Right. And just, I mean, if you Google Haitian Revolution, right, like there's just a huge amount of work, right, done on remembering these events. It seems like the thinker who becomes then most helpful for you in thinking about particularity in emancipation is Sylvia Winter, and particularly the concept of liminality that she develops. So how does she help you think against this problem in Badiou, or sort of like move past it, or like understand why it's a really important problem that does have another approach?
Yeah, I mean, so I want to say, like, if people haven't read the work of Sylvia Winter, I highly encourage you to go read her work. I think that she's a really impressive theorist, and that's true for many reasons. Like, she's very expansive in her way of thinking, and very very clear in some ways, and also very difficult to engage with in other ways. But in ways I think that are difficult are really important. Because she's doing really important work. And so, you know, if you read her essays are 90 pages long, and, you know, it takes you through some things. But there's a lot of
way to describe it.
I think she does that very much on purpose. And so I was drawn to her work because she's a system thinker, right? So she thinks this is very large, expansive systems. And she also engages in this relationship between particularity and universality. She also engages in thinking about the negritude movement. She doesn't talk about the Haitian Revolution, but I think, you know, there are a lot of really, really great overlaps or points of contact between Sylvia Winter and Badiou that for me made it really fruitful and made it really, really helpful to be able to bring them in conversation, while also showing how it is, you know, that Winter exceeds Badiou in these very important ways, particularly because of the way that she talks about universality and particularity, and also how she thinks about emancipation. And so, you know, I'm slowly working through all of her essays. I haven't gotten there yet. She's a very prolific writer, so it's going to take me my sabbatical, hopefully, to go through them all. But there's a lot of
sabbatical goal.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of really important things that she's engaging with. And so for her, when she thinks about particularity and universality, they're not mutually exclusive categories, which I think is really important. And so for Badiou and Sartre, you know, they create these sort of juxtaposition, either something is universal or is particular. You know, it's almost as though like one is good, one's bad, or one's political, one's not political, essentially. And for Winter, she's thinking about how it is essentially that universality needs to be filled by particularity. And I think it's a really beautiful way of sort of thinking about universality is not like this abstract thing that just sort of gets applied, but that like it comes from these various pluralistic positions, right? There's sort of no one place that it comes from. It's not like this pure universality that Badiou seems to be sort of presupposing, but instead is this very rich, dynamic, multiplicitous way of thinking about universality. It's filled almost in this, like there's an abundance, essentially, which I think is a really, really beautiful way of thinking about it. And so for her, you know, in contrast to Badiou, who says, you know, we start from what exceeds, for Winter, she starts with a liminal position. The liminal position is a position that's been marginalized in, you know, whatever space one's located in. And for her, the liminal position is a position from which change becomes possible. And so it's not, in a certain sense, this overarching system in the way that Badiou frames it. And I think of what he's doing is, you know, he has a very sort of conventional conception of emancipation sometimes. It's like, you know, the people take to the street and then they take over the buildings and then, you know, they institute a new structure. But I think that what Winter makes possible is thinking about all the various kinds of ways that we can think about politics, that we can think about emancipation as not just a sort of national struggle, but happens in a variety of other ways because it's based in this kind of, in this liminal position. And so the important thing for her is that the liminal position, you know, the liminal position exceeds the hierarchical structure in the same way that Badiou talks about, or in similar ways that Badiou talks about how it is that justice exceeds the state of the world that he's talking about. But for Winter, it's this, it relies more on thinking about W.E.B. Du Bois's double consciousness, you know, and so as an African-American man, W.E.B. Du Bois talks about, you know, how it is he both sees, you know, how it is that he sees how the world is for white people. He sees how the world is for him as racialized. And then he also has his own experience of himself in relation to his race, right? And so going back to the conservation of race, we have whiteness, we have the negative conception of race, but then we have the positive conception of race, you know, operating simultaneously. And so that in this position of double consciousness and this, and sort of maintaining this positive conception of race, that becomes a thing that exceeds the hierarchical structure. So it's not like looking to justice, this thing that's outside is based in people's lived experiences and how they become informed about how the world is organized according to those marginalized positions. And so, you know, for Winter, this is an epistemic position. You know, this is a position from which one can come to know. And it's through experience, these experiences, that one comes to know how the world is organized, and then also how the world could be organized differently. And so this is very different from what Badiou states, who says that, you know, the presumption that one might know the world differently in a certain sense because of their positionality is inherently problematic for him. Like it doesn't map onto it. I think one point in time he says, you know, that it's barbaric to think that someone, you know, who is queer would have a better understanding of how the world is organized according to, you know, queer and straight, for instance. And so again, this is a point that, you know, Badiou just can't get to the importance of positive conceptions of race and the kinds of things that it brings with it, like knowledge, this epistemic values and experiences. And so Winter draws on the negative movement for thinking about this possibility for this critical position. So understanding the critical position from which one could understand how the hierarchical structures operate, such that people are racialized, and then also from this positive conception of race as exceeding that present order. And so we can think about that in a certain sense. Like right now, there are folks who have conceptions that exceed, have conceptions of how the world may be differently than it is organized right now because of the way in which they are marginalized according to this social order. And so while Badiou is not concerned about that, Winter is more so concerned, starting from those positions rather than starting from essentially from above, it would seem for Badiou. And so she's interested in, new objects of knowledge. And so, she is an academic. She's very much engaged in thinking about academia in these ways. And she, she's had various relationships to, and she founded, I think it was the Africana Studies or department. And so thinking about the importance of engaging these questions within academia and elsewhere as well. But she's definitely interested in thinking about, what new objects of knowledge look like. And again, that's not just in academia, right? That's also, that's also new objects of knowledge exist in a multitude of places. But then for her also, the thing to recognize is that, this is inherently a political project, right? Negritude was a political project. Understanding of these positive conceptions of race, that's a political project also at the same time. And that starting from those little positions is both political and the site for change. And so, from this formal position, she also develops what she calls a pluriconceptual framework that she draws from C.L.R. James. If you read various Winter scholars, they'll talk about how it is that Winter has exceeded James in various ways. And so, she talks about how, if you want to understand class, you have to start with thinking about colonialism and the slave trade. You can't just think about class. You have to think about, you need to think about those positionalities before you can just sort of talk about class generally. You need to think about multiplicity of identities, multiplicity of oppressions, and that recognizing that, these multiplicities requires a multiplicity of solutions. There's not going to be a one-size-fits-all solution to the problem, that there's no single one mode of oppression that we can address and everyone will be free, but it requires instead this pluriconceptual framework. And so that's, for me, that's something that is really fruitful in Winter, is thinking about, it's going to be messy. And I think that's really true about how she's concerned with what's happening here. It'll be messy. It's not as though we can just sort of say, well, here's the solution. It has to be a multi-pronged approach from multiple positionalities, essentially.
Right, and there's all of these messy historical antecedents that we can draw from and see as informing the work of emancipation. Please.
Oh yeah, and just quickly, that is not all national conceptions of of resistance, right? So Angela Davis talks about how it is that Black women were poisoning slaveholders, when they were enslaved, and that those are political moments, and those are also moments in which, people, engage, their autonomy, and, they're working towards emancipation for sure.
Yeah, I love that actually, when you kind of linger on that, it doesn't always have to be these sort of like great big events that garner headlines, but that there can be this sort of like micro work of emancipation that we should also linger over.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So then I got to the last line of your book, and I'm going to go ahead and read the last two lines because I found them startling. And then I found myself really appreciative of them. And I would just love for you to talk about how this became the conclusion of your conclusion. So you write, "It is not my intention to save Badiou or compel others to engage with his political project. Rather, I aim to demonstrate the importance of reading decolonial theory writ large."
So the last line of the book. So basically, I struggled with why I wrote to write this book for a really long time, and I thought about that last sentence a number of times, and I revised it. I thought, given my critique of Badiou, given the inherent social problems I see with his work, I wondered, why should I write this book? Why should I contribute to Badiou scholarship in these ways? And why do I want to be part of that conversation? I think, there are better ways that I might spend my time. But I think that in some ways, it was important for me to write this book, and it was important sort of intervention to write this book. And that's in part because, you know, I didn't find anyone who was writing a Baijiu scholarship who was offering a critique of Baijiu in these various ways. And so one, I thought that was problematic because, you know, there are these cults that operate around Baijiu as though he's the most sort of radical thinker of the emancipation. And yet there are these inherent problems that I see with his corpus and his overall structure of his writing. But I also think that the problems that are located in Baijiu's work, they exceed his work too. And so they exist also in other areas of often, I think, you know, largely French political theory. And some of it, I think, goes back to the idea of the French, you know, the French state. And this happens in Quebec too, you know, where the public is free of religious symbols, for instance. And that's something that only exists, you know, in the privacy of your own home. But, you know, given that, you know, we maintain this idea, you know, there's that the presumption is that people can be more free because of it. But what ends up happening, like we see in Quebec, is that sometimes, you know, it turns really quickly into thinking, you know, well, no religious symbols often means, you know, well, Christian symbols are fine, but, you know, Muslim symbols are not fine. And so then we have the alienation of Muslim and Quebec folks in Quebec, for instance. And so, you know, I think that I think there's a really important move to be made in sort of engaging Baijiu in this way, and also, you know, other theorists as well. And the other thing too is, you know, I want to encourage more people to read, you know, decolonial theory. And so people who are reading Baijiu, you know, in a certain sense, I'm like, well, Baijiu's not the only game in town, you know. Go read Sylvia Winter, read, you know, Du Bois, read Fanon, and, you know, Outlaw, you know, all these wonderful, Catherine Sylvia Bell, all these wonderful scholars have been in this work for so long, who are engaging in the very same kind of questions that you might be engaging with, but coming from a different perspective. So that line is really like it's the evidence of, like, you know, I feel conflicted about it. I still feel conflicted about it in a number of ways. But ultimately, I hope that, you know, this engages people to sort of think more critically about Baijiu.
Well, great. And so what are you working on now?
So I'm on sabbatical right now. So I have two projects that are ongoing because I have more time, fortunately. And so one is I'm working on an edited collection on Baijiu and sexual difference, actually. And so one of the limitations of the book is that I don't actually engage with his conception of sexual difference. But, you know, to do that, I have to get into Lacan. So it's not just set theory, it's also psychoanalysis that I have to get into. And that just felt like a too big of a task to take on in the one book. And so in this edited collection, I'm working with people globally to think about the relationship between Baijiu and sexual difference, hopefully in these critical veins. And the second project, which is one that I'm more excited about right now, is I'm working on another manuscript on Sylvia Winter. And so this is why I'm reading her corpus and getting into all of it. I'm just the starting point of it, but it's thinking about, you know, how solidarity works through her corpus and her projects. And so thinking about the relationship between her work and critical Indigenous studies. And so sometimes there's a tension between you know, Black diaspora studies and critical Indigenous studies. And so how is it that my suspicion is that she's actually pretty careful in not erasing indigeneity in her project. And then also thinking about it alongside the feminist theory, environmental racism, and Marxism. So I just finished the chapter on environmental theory, environmental racism, and Winter. And so it's been a very enjoyable project to get into. So.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. Well, I look forward to reading it.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. This was a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, and thank you for having me again. I really enjoyed it, and I appreciate you having me on here.
Yeah, it was really my pleasure.